Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston Public School Superintendent Brenda Caselius has reached an agreement with the Boston Teachers Union so they can start bringing students back into classrooms in earnest. The phased return to hybrid learning, it begins February 1st. Now, we've been checking in with Superintendent Caselius throughout the pandemic, and she joins us again now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Superintendent Caselius.
Hi, Tiziana and listeners. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Now, I don't know about you, but I have aged a year in the last 11 days alone. So how are you? How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I'm happy that we've got this agreement behind us and we're able to provide some certainty to our educators and to our families who have been asking for that. We have a pathway forward for the remainder of the school year to open up safely and successfully. So I'm feeling some relief with that, as I know our families are. As we get ready to open up our doors further to more students.
You know, you talk about that sense of relief. I've been imagining that there must have been both collective sighs of relief and of worry from families as you announced this plan. And I wonder if there's been any response you've heard from a family member or a family in the system in the last 24 hours that is really sticking with you, that really comes to mind.
Well, I heard from Roxy Harvey, who has been on our HIP task force, our high in-person priority task force, working alongside us. And she's, you know, asked me about being able to return and could we return students sooner? And so, you know, they're anxious to get their students back and make sure that we want to be able to get all of our students back as early as possible, but to do so safely. She's just been wonderfully supportive, as has many of our parents and families. When we returned some of our schools, 28 schools, right before Christmas, I had a parent who said, you know, I was losing my child and felt like I was losing my child. And just 2 days of in-person, she told me that she just felt him coming back to her again, and it was just such a blessing. So, you know, there's those who are really happy to come back and those who are anxious to come back, and then those who are also real happy with their remote learning experience as well.
You know, that kind of leads into a question that I wanted to ask you. You talked about the family who felt like they started to see their child again, get their child back with just a couple days in the classroom. We know that Governor Baker has made it clear he believes it is largely safe to have kids in school and that the trade-offs make it necessary to do so. We also know we're in a tough situation. There is urgency for the reasons you just said. We are halfway through the school year, but our infection numbers are spiking, hospital capacity is challenged. Most kids are probably still several months from getting vaccinated. What about concerns that this is a great thing with bad timing, given that the rollout begins February 1st?
Unfortunately, this past year, since March 17th, there's not been anything that's been good timing. So that's been the struggle, is that no matter which way we go, that's no win. And because we just have not been able to have a long period of sustained numbers coming down on these metrics around the virus, it's made it quite challenging for school districts here in Boston, across the Commonwealth, and really across the entire country to open safely. And so now we're almost a year in, and it's getting to be quite a long time, and the cumulative effect of having children out of school is quite concerning for pediatricians, who believe that it's the best place for children to be in, educators who believe it's the best place for children to learn is in the person with their caring and loving teachers. However, we also know that our Boston Health Commission, who has been incredibly supportive to us and making sure we understand the emerging and changing and shifting science of this virus, has just been wonderful to us in helping us guide when it is safe to do so. So we will really lean on them and depend on them about reopening. And this is a timeline they feel comfortable with to give us enough time to watch it just a little bit longer before we have more students coming back.
There's so many things in what you just said, threads that I want to pick up on. I think I'll go first. You talk about the fact that we're getting close now to a year for a lot of young people in the Boston Public Schools to not have been in a school building. And you talked about the loss of learning there. At this stage, have you started to quantify that? Do you have a sense, especially for the most vulnerable learners, about what the magnitude of that learning loss is?
We have, and so we've been looking at their grades. It's been hard to assess students fairly, so we've been looking at their grades, and our high school superintendents especially have been working with the heads of schools to look at no credits and incompletes, and that's on the academic side, and so we've been doing work there. But then there's also this other side, our social-emotional impacts and the isolation, social isolation for children. That has been very concerning, and very concerning for our families, quite honestly, and wanting to get their children back in school for the social reasons that are so necessary for their mental health. So we're monitoring both of those with our coordinator behavioral health services, as well as our heads of schools and our counselors and social workers within our schools who are checking in with our kids.
And I'm trying to sort of get my head around this in a really concrete way. Are you seeing more loss than you expected over this period of time, sort of, you know, learning loss and social emotional development about the same as you expected? Have you been pleasantly surprised? Again, I'm just trying to, for a layperson, get my head around the magnitude of this.
Well, you know, we're a district with 53,000 students and 125 different schools. And I think what we see is a little bit different at different grade levels. So for instance, our early childhood, our children who are 3, 4, 5 year olds, who have a very difficult time sitting still in front of a computer to learn remotely, and young parents who may be having a challenge with trying to keep them engaged in that kind of learning, I think has put them somewhat more at risk of being behind. And then we see with our older students, our grades 9 through 12, also struggling because of the social emotional impacts mostly. Some of them also are having to care for younger siblings and also having to help the family through this crisis. And so we know that, and they've expressed to me, I meet with the student advisory and my youth council and my youth cabinet quite frequently, and they've described to me how very challenging it is to be in this type of environment. And I do want to say that for some students, we have been surprised, mostly at the intermediate grades, where this learning model has worked. Grades 2 through grade 6, they are much more engaged. It seems to be a platform where they are able to follow teachers' directions better. And the peer-to-peer, they don't have the same kind of inhibitions that maybe older children might have. So I think that has, you know, kind of been some of the observations that we've made. Concretely for grades for our high school students, we're about 4% more failures than we were the previous year.
So I want to pick up on two other threads and things that you've already said. You mentioned the 53,000 students that you're a steward for a moment ago. And earlier you said, no matter which way we go since March, it's a no win. What...
Well, it's challenging
to be in a no-win situation when you are stewarding 53,000 students.
Well, it's decisions making. I mean, so I think that there are wins that we're having. And there's lots that we're learning that I think we can apply. For instance, we've learned how to feed 3 million meals to children. We've learned how to become a one-to-one school district overnight, meaning getting kids on technology, and we've been able to successfully have remote learning for students, for many students. I guess when I'm saying a no-win situation was when we get into decisions about what direction to take next, because we've surveyed our parents, and it's no matter what, it always ends up being 50% want it this way and 50% want it the other way. Or when we talk to our teachers or educators or school leaders, you know, there's just a lot of opinions about how to move forward. And I guess that's what I mean in my earlier comment.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not, you know, the thing that I'm thinking, I'm just going to tell you, the thing that I'm thinking is there has to be some moment in the last year where you were like, man, I did not sign up for this, or I hit the wall here. Has that happened for you?
Well, I think it has happened for probably every superintendent in the nation that, you know, we're all working at least 10 hours a day, many times 12, 14 hours a day. It's quite exhausting. It's exhausting for our educators, and I want to thank them for their tireless work, as well as our school leaders, our facility staff, our custodial staff. I mean, everybody is working around the clock. I just had a new colleague start the work here just a week ago, and she was saying, oh my gosh, I just can't imagine. I've been doing yoga for 9 months, she said, and I can't imagine doing this pace of level of work for over the past year. So certainly yes, but getting up every day knowing that you're taking the next right step for kids is absolutely worthy work. And to be able to do it in a city that's been so incredibly supportive, no matter what. And I think the city pretty much knows that this is a very challenging situation. And so I have three words that I've been using all year: flexibility, patience, and grace. And Boston has just been fantastic in supporting us in that.
So let's go back to brass tacks. As students begin to come back into the classroom, when someone says to you, I need to know my child will be safe in that classroom, or a teacher says, as a teacher, I need to feel safe in that classroom, what are you telling them to give them confidence in their physical safety in the classroom as everyone begins to return?
It's easier when we can show them that it's safe, and when they get to the open school. So, you know, just to speak specifically, you know, in our 32 schools that we have open right now, once teachers come and they actually see the building and work with their other teachers, that's helped. But we have put in new HVAC systems, new filters for those HVAC systems, air purifiers in our classrooms, new monitoring and air testing that we've put in. We've ordered data loggers, which will give us on-time measurements so that we can mitigate anytime that it's not. And that's a measure of safety. We've also have personal protective equipment, PPE, for everybody in the school building. We have a hand sanitizer there. The custodians, who have been, oh my goodness, just wonderful, have been going around the school, spraying the high touch areas, cleaning down our desks. You know, we take time between our A and B groups to really do a good sanitizing between those two groups, limiting the number of students and staff in a building. You know, just a number of those things, plus all our other protocols with our school nurses, who have also been fantastic in helping us be the front line of really identifying quickly if someone's not feeling well, isolating them, and then making sure that they follow all protocols, you know, when we think there could be a case coming into the school.
All right, last question for you. This plan, you released it alongside the Boston Teachers Union. Just about a month ago, they had issued a vote of no confidence in you after the district announced an expansion of in-person learning for highest need learners. How did you get from there a month ago to a joint agreement now?
Well, it's a lot of talking, and it was during that time as well. And I think that was, you know, they're letting me know that this is serious, that they really were wanting these safety provisions to be expanded to all schools, which we had been doing. So I want to be clear that, you know, all of these safety provisions are in place and were in place, but it was really important to the union to have them in writing. And so as we continue to cultivate trust in this school district and to work toward greater and better collaboration, I think that's where I'm hoping this agreement will bring us toward. So I'm excited about what this will bring and the joint task forces that we will be announcing soon for summer boost and returning strong this fall will help us turn this corner into the new year.
All right. That is Boston Public Schools Superintendent Brenda Caselius. Superintendent, thanks for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, TCN. I hope you have a wonderful day and be safe and wear your mask.
Thanks, I will.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to give you some tough numbers here. 54 new confirmed deaths yesterday, more than 4,000 new cases, a 7-day average positive test rate above 7%. Just 4% of our non-surge ICU hospital beds are free in Boston as the post-holiday wave continues. We've had 140,000 people getting their first vaccine dose, and 1,200 have already gotten the second as the state's rollout continues. So that is where we stand right now on the coronavirus pandemic in Massachusetts. And so we're taking your questions. What do you need to know now? It's Ask the Doctors. Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to help answer those questions, two good friends of the show, Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Drs. Boucher, Barocas, welcome back.
Thanks so much, TC.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you. I will tell you, the phone calls are coming in already. So I'm going to ask each a couple of questions, and then we will go to the phones. Are we, Dr. Boucher, do you think, in the height of the post-holiday surge, or is the curve still going upward?
Well, Tiziana, I think we're afraid that we still aren't quite to the peak of this surge upon the surge. So we've probably seen some of the post-Christmas business, but we still will be waiting for the post New Year's, and I think it'll be another week to two before we see that in full force.
Does that make you feel kind of sick to your stomach? I mean, does that feel a little overwhelming?
It does, and as I looked at the numbers, you know, yesterday and today, it's really sad that, you know, this has been so predictable, and that we're seeing just exactly what we hoped not to see. And I just pray that we don't get to the place where our hospitals are pressed to the limit, that we can't give the care that our patients deserve.
Dr. Barocas, how are things going at Boston Medical Center?
You know, I was looking at the numbers earlier today from BMC, and we have luckily sort of moderated a little bit. We're holding steady, a little bit of a plateau right now. Everyone is still safe, able to give care. But I think that I just want to reiterate what Dr. Boucher said, that it's just sad at this point. It just causes an overwhelming sadness in me, that everyone is still suffering and it is also so exhausted throughout the city and the state and the country. It's just incredibly sad to me.
Are you too exhausted?
We have a steady flow of caffeine in our house. So I'm hanging in there. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, I would say the same, Tiziana. You know, I am hopeful as we vaccinate more, and it was such a hopeful day yesterday as we began vaccinating first responders. We obviously need to go a lot faster, but knowing that the vaccines are here makes me very hopeful and that much more resolute that we need to double down on our mitigation measures and get people vaccinated as fast as we can, because that's how we're going to get to better days.
All right, so we have a ton of vaccine questions here already. Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK, to join this conversation. Peter's on the line from Cambridge. Peter, what's your question?
Thank you very much. My understanding is that the vaccines prevent illness but not necessarily infection. So my question is whether it will still be possible after one is vaccinated to be tested for infection?
Okay, thanks for that question. Dr. Barocas, is that one you can answer?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, and there's a lot of meat to unpack in that question. So first and foremost, both of the vaccines that are approved after the two doses that happen somewhere between 21 and 28 days apart, you as a vaccinated person should have a substantial amount of immunity, meaning you're protected. That said, does not confer 100% immunity. It certainly doesn't confer 100% protection in the first 1 to 2 weeks after that first vaccine. So it's still possible, and we are seeing this on the ground, it is still possible to become infected in the period of time, first and foremost, between shot number one and shot number two. And even after that, it's still possible to much lower possibility, but it's still possible to become infected even after two shots. These are preventive, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're 100% effective. And that is why, that's one of the reasons why we still consider the this a another tool in the prevention toolkit, which includes masks and distancing, hand washing, and all of those things that we've been talking about for the last number of months. It's just one more good tool.
So not a panacea there. So let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. Let's go to Gretchen in Needham. Gretchen, what's your question?
Yes, hi. I wanted to know if there was a Massachusetts task force in place to implement and oversee the vaccine process. Excuse me. And if so, who is in charge? And if not, why not have a sort of a central command in place? With a website that can provide information about the timing when one could get the vaccine, how to sign up, and what the look and where the location might be.
Thanks for that, Gretchen. Dr. Boucher, do you want to start with an answer on that?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give it my best shot. So indeed, there is a task force for vaccines, and it's they are accountable to the governor. It's headed up by Dr. Paul Bittinger from the Mass General Hospital, and it has representation of really outstanding physicians and others who understand how to implement vaccination. And there is a place on the mass.gov website where there are updates on vaccination. I think it is hard for us because it's going in steps and we're still waiting to see what the next step will be, right? So we started with healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities. And then yesterday began first responders, that's police, fire, EMTs. And then we understand that the next phase will be people above the age of 75. And I think that is on the website. I think what's a question is what comes after that? And of course, when?
So, and I'm just going to add to that, excuse me, we're going to link to the mass.gov site that the doctor was just talking about, Gretchen, on our website, radioboston.org, and you can see there the vaccination plan over time, where to get a vaccine, et cetera. I'll also just note, again, we're in the early stages and in phase one, there isn't vaccination available to the general public. I know that there are still some questions about that. Before I go back to the phones, Dr. Barocas, I saw a conversation, actually, an interview in print with Dr. Paul Bittinger, who's the head of the task force, talking about what we do and don't know about the longevity of your, I don't know if immunity is the right word, I'm trying to be so careful with my language here, from the vaccine. And he was talking about 3 months, maybe, but maybe up to a year. We are relying a lot on being vaccinated to help keep us safe. So what do we and don't we know about the lifespan of the vaccination?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. What we know is based on the trial data that came out of the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine trials. And when those two companies put forth their application for the EUA, the emergency use authorization for those vaccines, we had 3 months of follow-up data. So many of us are knowing that we want to tread a very careful line, following the data as closely as we can. What we know is that these vaccines are effective up to 3 months. And it's only because we don't have data beyond that point yet. Those trials are ongoing. They will still follow people. They're not obviously still enrolling, but they will still follow people who received the vaccine under the trial for the next 1 to 2 years. So we will get a good, we'll sort of get updated information on the longevity of that vaccine, of these vaccines over a period of time. But for right now, we know for certain, just based on the data, that it's that we have that immunity, that protection for 3 months.
So just to clarify, we know 3 months because that's as long as we've been able to measure and track so far.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. That is very helpful. 800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Tony on the line in Arlington. Tony, go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if you know anything about teachers and if they will get the vaccine before the public schools fully open. I'm a teacher in the Boston Public Schools, a kindergarten teacher, and I would sure love to get the vaccine before I'm required to go back.
So thank you for that call, Tony. I will say what I know just quickly and hand it to you, Dr. Boucher. I'm looking at the phase two chart here from the mass.gov website. Phase two includes early education and K through 12 workers. That is logged as February through April as the time frame. Are we on track for that? Do you know, Dr. Boucher? And what else can you tell Tony, the teacher in Boston?
Yeah, well, so Tony, thank you for the work that you do. And I and many of us have been involved with helping the schools along the way, and I'm very excited for you to get back into the classroom. As Tiziana pointed out, currently teachers are in phase two. The CDC actually recommended moving teachers up a little bit, if you will, because they consider them to be like frontline workers because of the work that you do. Whether and how Massachusetts implements that is yet to be determined, but I very much hope that the vaccination will happen as soon as February. And you know, many of us in infectious disease and public health are advocating hard for that.
All right, the lines remain full, so let's go back for another call. Karen's on the line in Dorchester. Karen, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep, go right ahead, Karen.
My question is, I did unfortunately have the COVID and I'm past my isolation time. And I know I'm immune for a few months, but my question is, can I still bring it to my grandchildren and my family members?
Thanks for that, Karen. Karen, first, before you go, how are you feeling? You feeling okay now?
Yes, but my daughter-in-law, who is a teacher that got it in the schools, she actually is not feeling well. She's 20 years younger than me, at least, and she's very fatigued. And I seem to have bounced back pretty good.
Well, I'm sorry for her, but I'm glad you bounced back. Dr. Barocas, Karen's question about her ability to still be contagious for her grandkids.
Yeah. Well, Karen, first and foremost, I'm sorry that you and your family are going through this. I'll say the best that we know is that if you've passed that isolation period and of around 10 days, then we believe that you are, by and large, no longer truly infectious. This is based on a number of studies that have tried to grow the virus in people who have been infected at certain time periods in the future. So most likely you're not infectious. That said, I would still, this doesn't change anything. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't wear a mask. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't be practicing a lot of those same preventive measures that we've talked about. And if I may, Tiziana, just to add on to the, because we are talking about the vaccine, and this is a question that's been coming up a lot of people who have had COVID and should they get vaccinated? The answer is, yes, you should get vaccinated. If you've had COVID, there are some timing issues that are still being worked out, and certain states do things differently. But broadly, yes, the answer is if you've recovered from COVID, you should still receive the vaccine.
Thank you for that. In fact, I saw a caller that had just started to pop up with that question. So you jumped ahead, which is great. The more questions we can get answered, the better. So let's get another caller here. Kate's on the line from Bridgewater. Kate, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering what type of studies have been done and what is the safety factors and health risks for women who are pregnant or women who are trying to become pregnant with the vaccine?
Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so very important question, Kate. So first and foremost, studies are just beginning now in patients who are pregnant with the vaccine. So like many other medicines, they were studied first in people who are not pregnant. That said, there were a number of people who became pregnant during the trials, and we're watching those people are being monitored, as Dr. Barocas said. So we'll have some data on the outcomes of those pregnancies over time. What we know with this particular technology and these vaccines is that there is no reason to believe that they're going to be dangerous. And the toxicology studies in animals were finished for one of the vaccines and came out, as they say, clean with no evidence of any untoward events in those animals. The OBGYN societies have advocated strongly that the vaccines be offered to women who are pregnant and women who are nursing. And the official CDC and DPH recommendation is that these vaccines should be offered, and they should be, the decision should be made in discussion between a patient and her obstetrician or other physician as to the risks and benefits for her.
Thank you for that. Let's try to grab one more here. We've got Margaret on the line from Somerville. Hi, Margaret, what's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a similar twofold question that's similar regarding shedding of the virus following either a vaccination period or from someone who's recovered. And my question is, why can't we determine that by simply doing the PCR nasal swab on those people? And my second question is, if that's not feasible, what types of studies are being done to follow people to determine if they are, in fact, still shedding the virus after they have been vaccinated or recovered?
All right. Thanks for that, Margaret. Dr. Barocas, last question goes to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, those studies are ongoing. One of the difficulties in doing that up front was simply part of that, those phase three trials, the last leg of the clinical trial process for these studies enrolled 43,000 to, or 30 to 43,000 people, depending on the study. And so essentially trying to determine what we would call forward transmission, your ability to transmit virus even after being vaccinated, would have been well outside the scope of the study. That said, those studies are going on, and right now the best thing to do is assume that if you get the vaccination, you have some protection, but it does not, we definitely do not know right now if you're able to sort of harbor the virus and transmit. So better to be safe than sorry.
All right. That is as much as we have time for today. Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine. Also, Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. This is such a service to our listeners. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us and answer questions. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Marty Walsh may be going to Washington, but Bill Belichick isn't. The New England Patriots coach has decided not to accept the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Trump on Thursday. And that is just one of many recent decisions by Boston sports teams and their members that have really serious reverberations inside the sports world, but also outside of it. So here to help us check the score is Radio Boston's Chris Sidorick. Hey there, Chris.
And I'm breathing again. Oh, so relieved. That was a very tense 24 hours, let me tell you, TD.
So I think I have a sense of how you were feeling about it. Before we dive in, Chris, I just want to get listeners into this conversation. Listeners, call us. We also want to know, are you breathing a sigh of relief today? What do you make of Coach Belichick's decision not to accept the Presidential Medal of Freedom? Also, so much other news in Boston sports teams right now. You've got the Celtics and COVID. You've got the Bruins and their captain. Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Chris, take us into that news. Obviously, you are pleased with the decision.
Yeah, it was a really interesting 24 hours in the Boston sports scene. Basically, on Sunday, Politico reported that this Thursday, Patriots coach Bill Belichick would be accepting the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Trump. And then there was kind of a 24-hour period of, will he actually go? Will he decline? And then last night, Bill Belichick put out a statement that said he wouldn't be going. So I just want to read a little bit of that, and then we'll get into everything behind that. Quote, "Recently, I was offered the opportunity to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which I was flattered by out of respect for what the honor represents and admiration for prior recipients. Subsequently, the tragic events of last week occurred, and the decision has been made not to move forward with the award. Above all, I am an American citizen with great reverence for our nation's values, freedom, and democracy," end quote. So he's obviously talking about the insurrection that occurred last Wednesday. The agreement had been made prior to that, and then those events unfolded. And then the White House confirmed the reports that he would be attending to accept the award. So it's a really interesting decision for a guy in Coach Belichick that doesn't like to bring off-field stuff, or doesn't like to talk about off-field stuff ever, to have to kind of put himself in the middle of a story like that. Interesting time for the Patriots, for sure.
So, Chris, one more time where we see this intersection, this collision between sports, society, politics. I know there were a couple of golfers who actually did, the day after the insurrection, did receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom from the president. So any precedent for Belichick's decision this week?
Well, it is really interesting, and you hit the nail on the head there, Tiziana. This has really become so much more political in recent years. Just look at through the Trump administration. The Patriots went to the White House in early 2017 after their Super Bowl win. There were some players who skipped, but for the most part, the team was there. And then 2 years later in 2019, the team skipped the visit altogether and cited scheduling conflicts. But really, it was due to public pushback and kind of criticism of the idea of going to the White House for the visit. You've seen a number of teams across sports skipping White House visits. And I'd say it's definitely become much more common with this current administration. And I do want to highlight one interesting historical note. There is actually a Boston connection to turning down a Medal of Freedom. I don't know if you remember Mo Berg. We talked about him on the show a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. He was a catcher in Major League Baseball, played for the Red Sox for part of his career, and is believed to have been a spy. He never actually confirmed that during World War II. Doing kind of reconnaissance on trips to Japan. And so he declined the Medal of Freedom in 1946, never gave an official reason as to why he was declining that. Biographers have theorized that basically he didn't want to accept it if he couldn't explain to the public why he was getting it. But his sister Ethel ended up accepting it after he died and donated it to the Baseball Hall of Fame. So just an interesting historical note there. That it's not the first time a Boston sports figure has had to deal with this sort of decision.
All right, let's go to one of our calls, 800-423-8255, to reflect on Belichick, the Patriots, the Celtics right now, the Bruins. Join the conversation. Right now we've got TJ on the line from Arlington. TJ, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make the point, are we giving Belichick too much credit? It reminds me a lot of, you know, Lindsey Graham and some of the people that are jumping off the Trump train at the 11th hour and 58th minute. Because they've stuck through kind of racism, sexism, and all these other things, and are only really getting off at the last moment. Thank you.
All right. So, Chris, respond to TJ there. You and I have talked about this off air. Share your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And Bill Belichick has a connection with Donald Trump. If you remember back to the 2016 campaign, at the night before the election, Trump was in Manchester and read a letter that Bill Belichick had written him in support and kind of was touting his support in New England, hoping to gin up some extra votes kind of the day before the election. So much so that Belichick actually had to talk about it the next day. As I said, never likes to talk about the off-field stuff, but he did address the letter that he wrote Trump. And here's a little bit of what he had to say there.
Our friendship goes back many years. And I think anybody that's spent more than 5 minutes with me knows I'm not a political person. My comments are not politically motivated. I have a friendship and a loyalty to Donald. A couple weeks ago, we had Secretary of State Kerry in our locker room. It's another friend of mine. Can't imagine two people with more different political views than those two.
So, and that really kind of fits with Belichick's brand, that it's all football all the time. And to TJ's point, I think there was a legitimate concern here if he goes and accepts this award at a time when the president is potentially facing a second impeachment a week after an armed insurrection in the nation's capital. The entire sports world has been having this reckoning in terms of social justice, and Belichick ended the season by praising the work his players have done in the community on that front. And it really would have undermined that message, and I think probably cost him a lot of credibility in the locker room with his players. So I don't know that he really had a choice here. I don't know what he would have done if you take away all those factors. So that is kind of interesting to speculate about. But I think ultimately there was just so much public attention to this. It just would have been a real surprise, actually, for Belichick to go through with this. And it could have potentially been a distraction for the team down the road.
All right. We're going to take one more call on this subject. We've got Chris on the line from Duxbury. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. I guess what I was most curious about was the timing and the circumstances. So I was it a situation where the president didn't actually reconfirm with him after the events of last weekend? Because he put himself in a very embarrassing position through all of this.
I understand.
Yeah,
it's
a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. And we don't really know the answer right now. We know that Belichick had originally agreed before last Wednesday to go and accept this award. We don't know if the White House checked in with him or not. If, as I said, Politico reported it on Sunday. So you have to believe that the White House was already kind of in the motion of moving this plan forward for this week before that. We just simply don't know the timeline of whether they reached out to Belichick, if his opinion on it changed, if he kind of changed his mind about whether or not to accept it. Maybe we'll find out more as we go, but we'll just have to kind of wait and see.
All right. So we have been talking about an event that relates to Bill Belichick, but is not Bill Belichick. And that is not the only one. I know that was a little ham-handed, but it does strike me. There's this other thing we're all watching, and Bill Belichick standing on the outside of that, and that is that the Pats aren't in the playoffs. And Tom Brady is. And, you know, for our listeners who are not, I think you might have had to have been under a rock not to realize how important Tom Brady is to the fandom in Boston. But this is weird.
It's the first time in 11 years, Tiziana, that the Patriots haven't either been playing the first weekend of the playoffs or waiting to play someone the following week. You have to go back to the Matt Castle year when Brady went down early in the season in 2008. And it is odd as a fan of the team, admittedly. I kind of have enjoyed it. I mean, I would obviously rather have the team in the playoffs, but it has been interesting to watch the playoffs as an objective observer for a year. And Brady is still doing Brady things. He actually looked really locked in their game. Tampa Bay has some flaws, so I don't know if Brady's headed for another ring or not, but I would say based on the way he played this year, I would expect him to be back next year. And I don't know how many years he's going to play, but I don't think it'll ever feel normal to see him playing in a different uniform.
Yeah, it probably won't. All right, there's more we could talk to on football, but let's move to basketball because a lot with the Celtics this week too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Celtics, this story has been kind of moving as we go. Today they've had their second and third consecutive games postponed due to COVID. So they were supposed to play tonight against the Bulls. They're supposed to play tomorrow against the Orlando Magic. Both of those games have been postponed. We don't know when they'll make those up. Basically, for NBA teams to play, they have to have 8 players available to play. They've got 15 active guys on the roster for every game. So that just shows you the kind of toll that COVID is taking on this. Their game Sunday that was postponed was actually postponed because Miami couldn't field enough players. So it's not as if it's just a Boston problem. They're supposed to play the Orlando Magic on Friday. We'll see what happens with that. We aren't getting a ton of updates in terms of, you know, some of these guys are testing positive. Some are just being isolated because of contact tracing. And we aren't really hearing whether or not the contact tracing players are getting any negative test results back. So we just kind of have to wait and see. But, man, this NBA season could be in real trouble. We're only a couple of weeks in.
Yeah. So just for listeners who may not remember, last year the NBA was in a bubble. So they were really sheltered and isolated. They are not doing that this year. And what you just laid out, Chris, looks like the shape of things to come.
Yeah, and they're having kind of emergency meetings this week. I just want to add real quick that they may bring extra restrictions into play in terms of what guys do off the court in their private lives. They might have to really kind of tighten up in order to try to get through the season as they go here.
Interesting. So, you know, our theme today are these decisions by Boston sports teams that have consequences. Talk about the Bruins.
Oh, what a ride. So this one's a roller coaster. If you flash back a year ago, the Bruins were the best team in hockey last February, and then the shutdown happens. They do the restart a few months later. They never quite look like the same team. They never kind of hit their rhythm, and they get bounced by Tampa Bay, the eventual champions. They've had a couple of huge losses so far the offseason. Torrey Krug, probably the most significant player production-wise. But I got to tell you, I hate to see a guy who's a real character guy like Zdeno Chara leave. So he had been with the Bruins for 14 seasons. He was the captain and really was the leader in every way. Had played through a broken jaw at one point.
Jeez.
Wired shut, basically. Had to eat food through a straw, but was still on the ice trying to do what he could for this team. He's 43 years old, so he's not the player he used to be, but he wanted to come back, and he definitely can still contribute in a meaningful way. The team decided they want to go in another direction. And you could really feel it kind of as the team was getting bounced. I want to play a real quick clip here from Doc Emmerich, who calls hockey games for NBC, or did call, he's retired, but said in August, as the Bruins were bounced after a double overtime loss, and the camera was following Chara shaking hands with some of the Lightning players. Here's what Doc Emmerich said.
It is likely the last time we're going to see him in a Bruin uniform. I hope you don't mind I shift gears from hockey, the humanity that this guy has. Over his span of time in Boston, he's reached out to oppressed groups. He's made donations of time and food and clothing, as a lot of guys do. But if he were coming to your home for dinner tomorrow night, he'd want to talk about you and your family and not himself.
So just speaks a little bit to the kind of guy that Chara was. All players loved him and respected him. Sad not to see him back. And he signed for under $1 million. So I have a ton of frustration with the team there. It seemed like they could have brought him back. But I do want to highlight one positive note before we go. The Bruins announced today they're going to retire Willie O'Ree's jersey to the rafters, number 22. Willie O'Ree is the player who broke the color barrier for the National Hockey League. And in addition for the Bruins retiring his number, actually NHL players across the league are going to wear helmet decals that depict O'Ree with his kind of trademark fedora. From January 18th, which is obviously Martin Luther King Day, it's also the 63rd anniversary of Willie O'Ree's first game with the Bruins. They're going to wear those decals through the end of February. Nice. And I just want to highlight a moment. We actually had Willie O'Ree in the Radio Boston studio with Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2016. He was talking about the documentary Soul on Ice, which features stories of black hockey players throughout history and the future of black hockey players. And here's a little bit of how he described his experience playing in the NHL.
Playing here in Boston was great, but playing in other cities, I had racial slurs and racial remarks, you know, directed towards me because of my color. But
from whom? From the fans?
Players and fans, yes. But it didn't affect me, and I didn't let it affect me. I just says that I'm good enough to be here, and if they can't accept me for my play, then just put it aside. But it was tough at the beginning, but later on it got a little easier.
And one final note, which I just think is great. He actually said he didn't even realize he had broken the color barrier for hockey until he read it in the paper the next day.
Wow. Well, I do want to note that the Boston Red Sox also made news this month, hiring Bianca Smith, who will be the first black woman to coach in professional baseball. So lots of momentous decisions by Boston sports teams. Thanks for checking the score with us, Chris Siderick. I know we'll have you back again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Chris. And that, folks, is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mischel, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening and calling in today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.